who's the other guy who did the big mural in Brixton for the atomic bomb and everything?
With the skeleton.
Yes.
Brian Barnes.
Brian Barnes, yes. Great Brian Barnes. No, I mean, that was a terrific mural. But it wasn't done in silicate. I think it was done in oil or something, or acrylic.
Yes.
So they have short-term lives. But maybe that's a good thing, that the murals have short-term lives.
Yeah. Well, there was a thinking that they had a natural life of about 5 years, or what the life of the paint, and that's what you worked with.
Yes. I think the Earlham Street mural, by the time it was pulled down, by the time they pulled down that building, that had faded quite a lot.
Actually, it's interesting because your Brixton mural has a lot of red in it, and that's one of the colours that don't last very much at all, is it?
No, it's not. It's iron oxide.
Iron oxide.
Forever. That's why you go around the countryside here, and you'll find that a lot of farmhouses are painted with iron oxide. Well, first of all, because this area is famous for iron. They built a massive chain across the Hudson to stop the British getting up there from the local iron foundries. But iron oxide lasts a long time. It's not affected by sunlight. And so all these pigments used in that mural are light fast. They're all from pigments, specifically that kind of carbon supplied for murals. Have you ever worked with silicate?
Yes. We did a piece mural. One of the 6-piece murals in London. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. And they're different. It's a Pozzoli red that I used. A Pompeii red. They called it Pozzoli red. And I the way I painted that, I remember now, was through a kind of cross hatching.
Okay.
Everything was painted in lines. With a brush, with these big brushes. And the pigment was built up on the wall over days and days. It took about a year to do that. Can't remember. It was completed in 82. I think it may have taken 2 years.
So you put several layers of the same colour on?
I believe so. I think it was, it was all just water-based and hatched on in a certain direction until the thing built up. And then when the mural was finished, then I sprayed it over a period of like 10 days or more with very dilute silicate until that built up in the wall.
Yeah.
But the parapet was never great, and I told them about that, but I guess there was not enough money to fix it properly or whatever. And that's the reason it needed to be renovated. I think it was Paul Butler, I'm not quite sure who did it, who was commissioned to do it, a few years ago. They had, there was water coming from the parapet, so that caused, it wasn't the pigments that were aged, it was the efflorescence of the plaster that was causing the problem.
Right. So the water was coming over the roof.
Water will destroy any building and any brickwork in a fairly short period of time, actually. It's amazing that it took so long. But, that goes down through the plaster. It mixes with salts in the plaster or the brick and efflorescence. So one thing I knew from my construction days is that when you render a wall and you have people plaster the wall, you have to, which is actually one of my trades as well, I can also do very high-end plastering, you have to watch the workers that they don't urinate in the sand, because that causes big problems to the wall. If you really want to destroy a building for the future, you take a leak in their sand, because the salts cause efflorescence in the plaster. The salts attract moisture. So if you ever have a wall plastered for a mural, keep your eye open for the work with them and keep your eye on them. They'll do it. Yeah. Yeah, I was paranoid about that because I knew that trick, you know, so I eye on these guys and make sure they kept away from the sand.
Good.
I don't know why I'm talking about that.
That's all right. We women don't have that problem.
Yeah.
One thing I'm just want to explore a little bit further. You talked earlier, and I've forgotten the title. You worked together. Was it Art in Democracy or what?
Art in Democracy. Yes, it was a group that came around together around. There was John Duggar, myself, and Stephen Sprung, who was also at St. Martin's with me, who went on to make physical films and cinema action. Many artists. Cecilia Vicuña was one of the artists who is now doing quite well, still a Chilean artist. And we all, I think, came together around this idea of the coup in Chile and the terrible thing that had happened there, and the silencing of intellectuals and musicians and artists by the junta. I guess you know the story pretty well, where the people were rounded up and taken to the National Stadium and tortured and murdered. Victor Jara. I met Joan Jara, his wife, in London. I met a lot of the Chilean refugees in London at the time who had managed to escape. But many didn't escape and were disappeared, or murdered or brutally tortured, as Victor Jara was. I believe when he tried to sing in the stadium to keep people's spirits together, they took his hands and they alternatively put them in hot water, boiling water and cold water, and destroyed his hands, and then they shot him and dumped his body on a roadside. So we were all very moved by that and politicized by that. Plus we understood the how this coup had been manufactured, by the involvement of the CIA and American capitalist interests in Chile at the time, and the contradiction of America professing to be a democratic nation and destroying the democracy of another nation because of the because basically, Allende had nationalized the Kennecott copper mines at the time, and so that affected America's capital interests in Chile. It's different now, but basically at that time, America had been very paranoid about its so-called backyard, Latin America in general, and interfered in South America's politics on a regular basis, was the instigator or manufacturer of coups in Latin America at the expense of local democracies and the people there, tragically so.
What sort of form did the work take that you produced as part of Art in Democracy?
My work got increasingly political. It's very naive now when you think about it, but this preceded the murals. As I said, I did a painting of Alba Neruda and Salvador Allende, and I did paintings of construction workers at the time. Cable Street is an angry mural. And you can say, okay, those are identifiably political murals. The mural done by Binnington and Rochford on the West Wing is overtly a political mural. But I think anything that's put in a social or public context is a political painting, whether it's abstract or decorative, not necessarily decorative, but, you know, figurative or whatever, that the reaction, by putting it in that context and having a social interaction with it, creates a kind of political statement.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the upshot of all of that was they did a final seminar. They did an exhibition and a final seminar. And within it, there was a art critic called, I think it was Owen Hathaway. And as part of his summing up of the whole project, he said, well, the community arts murals, the murals that we'd all been painting, essentially were municipal art. And I was sitting behind Paul Butler, and we both sort of, as one, leapt in the air and said, what?
Yes.
You know.
Well, yeah.
And that was like the impetus to this project, to look at, you know, was what we were doing municipal art? I don't think it was, because we were all having to carve funding out of anything that we could look at, really, weren't we? And also, it wasn't done for local authorities. It was done for, you may have got funding from local authorities, but it, essentially it was done with and for the communities we were working with. Mm. It's taken about 3 years to fund this project so that we could do it. And, of course, the Arts Council didn't want to know. Oh. And so it's being funded by our Heritage, Heritage Lottery Fund, which is interesting, I think, in itself. So that's some of what we do. And then one of the ways that we developed from mural painting was that you, in fact, Earlham Street was an example for us, because we saw you building a garden and painting a mural, and there were all the other gardens of Covent Garden. No, I'm not.
I thought Greenwich Mural Workshop was like, you know, really big setup there, and, you know.
Well, are
you using me as an example? Come on.
No, it was because we, round the corner from one of our first murals, which was on Creek Road, there was this derelict site, which essentially was the footprint of a house and garden. And we spent ages, we saw what you'd done, and we said, well, you know, there's this Meridian estate, which is bound by the River Thames one side and Creek Road, which is a big commuter road, the other side.
Yeah.
And they don't have gardens. So we went to Greenwich and said, look, you know, why can't we create a temporary garden here? Yeah. And we managed to, in front of the mural, out of what had been a GLC car park, you know, a lorry park.
Right.
And but the other side, this little, well, it wasn't that little, it was probably about 120 foot by 20 foot across, they wouldn't let us near it, because they thought once we created a garden there, they'd never get the land back. And it was derelict for 20 years.
Oh, that's terrible.
Isn't it? So, yes. But it was... Partly yeah, seeing your mural.
It's on all those gardens. You know, those gardens were wonderful.
I know, yeah. Well, interestingly enough, years later, because at the time you were working in Covent Garden, I did a... I'd done a degree in town planning.
Oh,
and I got a scholarship and came to New York and Chicago. And
when is this?
That would be 74 that I did that. Yeah.
74.
Yes.
That's before I before
that's
I
before you did, but you know that at the time that was all the you know, the Covent Garden Community Association and was going on.
Yeah.
And much later I've met a guy called Jeff Holland, who was working with the GLC and actually facilitated some of the community work that was done in Covent Garden at the time, and you know, helped stop some of the worst redevelopment that went on there.
So, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the redevelopment that happened in the end was housing for the people there, and I was part of the committees that pressurized it. You know, I was like on the Quango DLC, I can't remember, it was called the Forum, and which, you know, represented the people, different area, each of us represented an area in Covent Garden. I represented my block, I guess.
Well, you probably knew Jeff at the time.
I think I did, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Christina Smith was on it, David Beder was on it, I was on it. I guess Jeff Holland would have been on it as well, I guess, the Forum. And the housing that was built on the Oldham site and eventually other housing in the area was all a result of those organizations.
Yeah, you know. So...
it's a very important organization as well, of course.
Yeah.
There was a group of architects that was very important in the area that worked on short life housing and became permanent housing there.
That was very, very interesting time because...
Dave Beder ran Street Aid. It was an interesting time because there was such vitality, you know, and this kind of combination of all these young professionals working with the local community was extraordinary and cut through bureaucracy. You know, amazing things happen, and they happen very quickly. And I don't feel that those kind of things can happen in the same way anymore.
No.
Because it has to go through so much planning and, you know.
Yeah. Well, perhaps we can have another session. It doesn't have to be a very long one, but pick up on some of those points. Because I think, you know, some of the things that you've said are very important, like, you know, them being angry murals and, you know, the...
So they're about, yes, the violence of resistance.
Yes.
And whereas I think that the murals I did were more about celebrating community. There are different kinds of... And both are very important. You know, one of the Mexican murals were about resistance, I think, in general.
But they were also about education, weren't they, as well? You know, that, I mean, that was how they were funded, was through an education program. So by, what was his name, Vasconcelos, and who said, we've got an illiterate population who need to understand the importance of their cultures.
And
I think it was an important time. That's why hopefully this will, you know, what we're doing will come together as a record of what we were trying to do. And, you know, did we think we succeeded? Well, yes, no, you know, it's... perhaps you never totally succeed. I don't know, but...
I think everything you do has a consequence. I think even if it's short-term, whatever you do affects someone else. You know, I mean, I never realized that people who were infants at the time I did that mural in Brixton would grow up, you know, loving it as part of their community and making hip-hop music about it. You know, just something on YouTube about this mural. I was completely, like, when this came back to me all those decades later, I thought, what? You know, make hip-hop music about this goddamn mural? That's amazing, you know. Or someone forms the London Preservation Society because they lived across the road from this and saw Ruth Miller. I find that extraordinary. So it has that kind of effect on people, you know. So everything you do has a consequence. It affects other lives, hopefully in a positive way.
Yes, absolutely. Good. Well, thank you, Stephen. It's been fascinating. It's nice to meet up again. I remember meeting you several times, but gosh, it was such a long time ago.
So. It may have also been around the time of the attack on David Binnington's mural in Cape.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
I think we had a meeting where we all were trying to decide what to do and who could participate on it.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. I couldn't at the time because I think I was engaged in the Brixton mural.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was very shocked when Ray Walker died. I always remember that.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And he was really prolific as a mural painter.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, he was. And a good, you know, very interesting painter. He was an angry painter, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he was also...
He was an angry man.
Energetic. he was a very genuine person.
Yeah.
And incredibly, is the last person you'd expect just to die in his sleep.
I know.
Because he was a really tough guy and very stocky. But he had rheumatic fever as a kid, and that weakens your heart.
Apparently. Yes. Gosh, I didn't know that was the cause. So.
Mm. He had rheumatic fever, and I didn't know that, and until later. And the curious thing is that I didn't know about his funeral somehow. I didn't know about it. And in fact, I found out about his death by someone just came into my studio one day, and he says, "Yeah, your friend Ray Walker, because he'd been to my studio a number of times, you know, he died." I was like, I just got off my bike and I nearly fell down in my seat. I thought, what? How can this happen?
Yes.
And anyway, so I eventually went out to the cemetery and with someone, and I couldn't find his grave. And I had some incense with me, and I found an empty plot, which had looked for, not an empty plot, a fresh grave. And I thought, maybe this is it. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And I just put some incense sticks there and lit some Japanese incense sticks and lit them and meditated for a while. And then on the way out, I met eventually the gatekeeper for the cemetery, and I said, "Do you know where Ray Walker's grave is?" And so he brought me back into the cemetery to show me. He said, "Oh, it looks like someone's just been here. They put these incense sticks on his grave." His grave.
That's amazing. Gosh, spooky. He was obviously Irish. Talking to you.
Yes, Irish, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we went to the funeral, and there was obviously sort of, it was interesting because there were obvious groups of bits of his life, you know, so there were family and there were artists and there were his political groups. And everyone was standing up and saying, you know, why Ray was important to you. And it was all the people that were most vocal were his political companions or the artists. Yeah. And not that I spoke or anything, but Des spoke at length. And then suddenly, I think it was one of his cousins stood up. And he was really angry, and he said, "And he was our family, you know, and it doesn't matter whether he was political or, you know, an artist. We've lost our relation." And it sort of put everything into perspective then, you know, that we, you know, everyone was mourning him in a different way, but...
Yeah.
But they were being edged out. It was
for someone who's loved by people. You know,
yes, yeah. Not for what they do or they think, but for what they are.
A wife and a young son at the time.
Yes,
I wonder what happened to them.
No, well, Anne worked with Mick Jones, and his wife worked with Mick Jones to paint.
Complete one of the murals.
Yes, he completed, because we set up a London Muralist for Peace group, which was Ray, Paul Butler, Brian, Dale McRae, Pauline Harding, Stephen Lobb and myself.
Stephen Lobb?
Yes.
Oh, I know that name as well. Yes.
He, well, we were married at the time, and he...
Oh, Stephen you were talking about.
Yes, that's right, right. Yeah.
Stephen Lobb, yes.
Yeah, and used... well, because of, I think, through Ray's influence, actually, decided to do the murals using Kaim-Farben. So yeah. we bought it in bulk and, you know, divided it up between groups. And that was funded by the GLC, through Tony Banks at the time.
Yeah.
And, Anne and Mike painted the mural. And then I think last year Paul Butler went back and repaired it again. So, but not in Kaim,
because it had been.
No, it had just deteriorated because it's on a traffic pollution. So it's still there and it's looking very good. Yeah. So, but it was. One of my fond memories of Ray is that Ray sort of decided that he was the person who knew all about Kaim-Farben.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to tell us, you know, when we could paint and when we couldn't paint. And he phoned up about 7:30 one morning.
Yeah.
And I got up to answer the phone, and it was snowing like mad outside. And he said, "You're not to go out and paint today."
Yeah.
I said, "Ray, not only have I not even got up, have you looked out of your window? Because it's snowing."
Yeah.
But there's like a certain temperature below which you can't use it, isn't it? So
yes, and I think probably, you know, the drier it is, the better.
Yes,
sucked into the plaster.
Although we found that working when there was sort of a very hazy rain was really good. It seemed to sort of, well, you didn't have to, you know, the proper way of using it was that you had to wet areas of the wall first and then you painted onto it.
Really?
Well, this is how Ray told us we had to do it.
I don't think so, because I think the whole idea was that you've got ideally you have a calcined rendering.
Yeah.
And you have mineral pigments.
Yes, that's right, in distilled water.
And the wall has to be like a sponge, a dry sponge, the pigments into the wall, into the substrate, not lie on the surface. If you're going to moisten the wall first, then the pigment is going to lie on the surface of the wall.
The pigment's in liquid form, isn't it? Well, it's suspended in...
It's suspended. You want as much of that to be sucked into the wall.
Sucked in.
If you have a dry wall, that's ideal. It's going to be sucked in. And then... Again, you know, you want to be spraying the silicate off the wall.
Oh, yeah, when it's dry.
Dry weather,
absolutely.
Too. And what happens is that silicate binds with the mineral and the mineral thing of the wall, and it becomes like quartz, you know, like stone.
Well, it's there for, 90 years, they say?
For a lifetime,
apparently. Yeah, yeah.
I read about it in a book at the time, like it was Mayer was talking about it, like water glass or something. Like anybody who does this has to be sure of what they're doing, because it's going to be around to embarrass them. And sure enough, I didn't really pay any heed to that. But yeah, there it is. It's embarrassing me.
Well, it's slightly ironic, isn't it, that the mural that you least like is one that's going to be there forever.
Yeah.
So, but yes.